Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Well, what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld Podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance in the Crawl Space Studios in Wormtown. What's up, Lance?
Oh, not too much. Feeling pretty good. How are you today, Tim?
I'm doing well. And Lance, this episode is the third episode in the series we're doing on the unsolved murder of Sheila Shepherd from 1980 in Saratoga Springs, New York. If you haven't heard the first two, it would behoove you to go back and listen to the first two before you proceed.
Yeah, pretty exciting getting to the third episode here. It was super exciting. I know I've said this numerous times, working with the investigators on the case, the current investigators, Matt Wilson and Chris Callahan, and the information that they opened up to us was unexpected at times, Tim, a little disturbing at times, but sort of an honor to be in the presence of people who work so hard on this case. And Sheila Shepherd was murdered in 1980 in her apartment in Saratoga Springs, New York. She was found tied to the bed with her hands and ankles tied to the bed frame and to the bed posts. And she was discovered by her uncle after a few days of her being unresponsive to friends calling. They were concerned. People where she went to school were concerned. And her uncle and her aunt and her mother went to her apartment. Her uncle climbed up the fire escape through the window, and that's when he found the body of his niece, of Sheila. He went downstairs and made sure that nobody else went into the room, and the police were called. That's where we found out that she was stabbed in the stomach, right around the torso area. Postmortem, that was determined after testing was done. And to this day, it's the only unsolved murder in Saratoga Springs history.
Okay, so let's get to this third episode in our series on Sheila Shepherd.
And in this clip, we ask the investigators, Callahan and Wilson, why was it them? Why did they feel compelled to be the ones to take this case up once again and try to generate new life into it?
Why did you guys pick up this case?
Why you two? I had asked about it a while ago. When I was a kid, I used to hear my parents talk about this case all the time. We used to go to Maine in the summer every summer for vacation. I remember my parents in the front seat talking about this, and thought it was really interesting then, especially being from Saratoga. You don't have unsolved murders, and to hear that had happened here and just the circumstance of it, I thought it was really interesting. And first became a police officer, I was interested in it. I read back through the computer, and there was very little in our computer about it. And then I became an investigator. Our now assistant chief was the head of investigations and had mentioned that they were looking to reopen this. This was anybody interested, and I went to him and I said, yeah, absolutely, I'd love to work it. And he was going to pair me up with a investigator who had been on in 1980, who's since retired. And then
when I got promoted out back, it was the same thing. I had known about it growing up here. My father was a police officer here through the 70s and the 80s up until you know, mid-2000s. So a lot of these names I know, and it's just a timing thing. I don't know why they never picked it back up, probably because it was exhausted. And like everything, time flies, and it kind of gets put on the back burner, and you know, life goes on, and nobody really looks at it until you see it sitting in a box somewhere, and you wanna kind of dive into it again, see if anything you missed, you know, fresh eyes, you know.
Yeah, it was never closed. It was never like they had closed it out, but it was just kind of a matter of, I know they had a couple of people that had been assigned to it that had looked into it. One of them had been assigned to it, then he got promoted, so he went back to patrol, and you know, I think it kind of passed through a lot of different hands, and I think, I mean, I don't want to speak for anybody who came before us, that Matt and I were the only ones that said, you know, like, no, I, you know, want time. You know, unfortunately, we don't have a big enough department where they can just exclusively let us devote to work in this case, but it's kind of when you have time, and you know, in between, you know, slow times with other cases coming in, then we've just been working this wherever we can, wherever we get a chance.
And it's one of those cases where we're getting to the point now where a lot of the younger officers that are coming on were not born during this time. You know, I hate to say that I'm getting old, but they don't know about it other than from what we tell them. So they don't have access to that case like you know, with older cases on the computer. So it's everything's all on paper. So, you know, at some point after we go, unless somebody else thinks of it and picks it up, you know, it's
well, I wasn't born actually when it happened.
I was.
You're like, no,
when
don't,
I came
don't,
along.
Don't date me, right? So it was sort of unofficially, like informally opened back up again? So because it wasn't officially closed?
Yeah, you would say, yeah. I mean, they you know, I guess you would suspend something and then, you know, kind of look into it again.
Yeah.
You know, the way they wrote up the case report then to now, I mean, we'd have to go and take a new case report and now make it all digital, as opposed to everything that was added to it from 80 to almost in the 90s. Up until about 99 when we got the impact system, was all handwritten documents attached to the case file. So now when we looked into it, now we're taking a whole new digital number to it.
Yeah.
So. Well, I got lucky also. I was deployed. I'm in the reserves. I was gone for a year, and I got home last November. I came back to work, and my boss at the time was like, you know, you got all your vacation time to use, so I was going to be out. You know, I was at work very sporadically, so he's like, why don't you take the rest of this year when you are here? We're not going to assign you new cases. I was working in the drug unit at the time. He's like, we're not going to assign you any of these cases. Why don't you just, you know, sink your teeth into this? We'll give you through the end of 2018. So that's when, you know, we'd set up a lot of our interviews. And when we first look back into it, there's a, you know, a list 10 pages long of people you want to talk to and people you want to see if they're still alive. So that was when I really had time to fully devote just to that. And Matt, I know the sergeant had cleared him up. He's like, you know, when you guys have things going on, go ahead and focus on that. And like I said, now we're kind of back to working it in between, you know, other things coming in
and stuff. Yeah.
Open investigations we have.
Yeah. What else do you have for open investigations here?
So I was primarily in the drug unit up until a couple of weeks ago. I just went back to criminal investigation, so that was a whole obviously different world of just, you know, running leads down or tips about this place a drug house or this guy's a drug dealer, and you know, that type of cases. We both do arson investigations for the department, so any suspicious fires that come in, Matt and I are the ones that they handle those. I don't know, it's different. We're not NYPD, so we don't have like specialized units. We're all kind of a jack of all trades back there, and comes in, if it's your turn to get a case, then whatever it is, you know, it's a rape, a fraud, you know, whatever it may be.
Do you think that the killer is still in the town?
You know, I
don't know. There's no, you know, it's one of those things, like one day I'm like, he's here, he's probably watching us, and then other days I'm like, this guy is probably somewhere gone in another state somewhere, if not dead. You know, he kind of passed through, did his thing like a serial killer somewhere, and then we just never linked him. You know, it's just one of those, I can't say yes or no.
There's been a bunch of suspects, especially when I first started going through this case. With the case file is two giant, you know, binders plus a lot of throw-ins and a full tote, you know, of a case. So they're initially reading it. There was three or four people where I'd read and say, "Oh my, this is our guy." You know, it's definitely is our suspect. And then you go in further and you hear about somebody else. You're like, "Well, this is our guy, and this sounds like him." And it's, you know, there's definitely, it's not like a very cut and dry where there's, you know, one person where I'd, you know, you could say,
yeah,
that's our killer, you know, that's our suspect.
There's, she also, I mean, she was gone. She moved back from Colorado from back in what, August? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, she's just newly September. Back in town, or September.
Wow.
You know, she's young, but at this point in her life at what, 20?
22.
She's already has a kid. She's always been married. She's already separated from the husband, and now she's back living here in a town where her social life is more of a downtown life, where she comes into contact with lots of people. So now you start looking, well, I remember hanging out with this person, hanging out with that person. So all these names start to jump out just because of, you know, her lifestyle and how she's been living for the last few years of her life. Mm-hmm. So.
Were a lot of those people that you mentioned in the case files as being persons of interest, were a lot of those people interviewed?
Oh, yeah. They interviewed a lot of people.
Yeah. Interrogated everything?
Yeah, you know, we weren't there for the, you know, I don't know what the, I know they brought a lot of people in to talk with them.
It was kind of one of those things when we first opened it, when we first started looking into it, that I love those cold case files and Datelines and those shows where they solve these old homicides. Like, you know, kind of selfishly, you hope, like, well, I hope we'll come across something glaring, like, well, they missed this or they didn't talk to this person. It'll be an easy, you know, go focus and talk to them. And one of those ones we hear it solved because there's some guy that was just missed and never talked to. And there really wasn't any of that. It was, you know, as far as reading back, like, the detectives at the time just ran down every lead, you know, every viable name, and there's stuff that comes in that is crazy, and even that stuff, they're talking with, you know, people that say, I had a dream that so-and-so killed her, like, okay, and they go and they interview them, even though it's based on in nothing, but, and the detective at the time actually ended a detective lieutenant, went out to Colorado and talked to people that she knew out there at the time, like, is it possible somebody came back here, the old boyfriend, or... Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Guys in California that she knew, she'd been out there for a time, that they interviewed, and you know, there really wasn't any stone unturned that I saw going through the case file.
And this next clip, we're walking the streets with investigators Callahan and Wilson and talking about some of the bars and the scene in that day.
That one video I sent you, the news story, they got this place behind her. It's like a yellow sign up here with black lettering.
Yeah.
It says the Golden Grill. And you can, just kind of an interesting, like, how far Saratoga's come back around the corner here where the library is now. It's, like, literally just piles of, like, rubble.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
It looks like modern day, like, Detroit. You know, some of the areas that are just, you know, abandoned. And, like I said, that urban renewal, really.
Yeah, this was all bricked over. So these glasses were not here. Mm-hmm. And this bar was more of a bar you wouldn't bring your first date. It was...
yeah.
Kind of a reputation. There were a lot of fights and stuff going on in there.
Definitely a rough, you know, rougher scene in general back in that time. You know, talk to the older officers, and you know, I'm sure Matt's dad could tell you. You know,
it was probably
having your nightstick out every night. You know, coming to these bars and break up fights.
Not that way now, though.
Not as much. I mean, we definitely still get our problems, especially the big nights, but you know, for the most part, people are pretty well behaved, especially when you look at the huge numbers of people that will get down here. And you know, in the summertime, a busy night, you'll get 10,000 people on a street that, you know, two and a half blocks long. So
yeah,
you know, we certainly got our hands full, and that's with like eight cops or so working.
This was just empty at the time.
Yeah, if you look at that shot I'm talking about from the news story, I thought that was pretty interesting. When you see in the background, it just looks like...
Yeah, it wasn't much.
Yeah.
So if you're moving, going to any of the other bars, I mean, there was a bar up on Filer Street, but mostly you're going to walk this way to hit any of the bars, maybe on the way home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my guess would be if she was here last, she's going to go down through here and either up Caroline Street to Broadway to home. This was Madame Jamel's. There was a bar down here that a lot of people frequented. It was kind of popular at the time.
And now we start talking about some other cases that happened in the area. And the beginning of this clip, we are near a bar now that's called Dango Fitzgerald's in Saratoga Springs. It used to be called something different back in the day. But I think this is kind of an interesting part as well. See if any of these cases could be connected.
And one of those cases, which is an unsolved murder, but in adjacent county, happened 6 years after Sheila Shepherd, and it's interesting to hear their take on that. It was a young woman named Pamela DeVizio. She was last seen leaving a Saratoga bar on July 4th, and she was found just outside the jurisdiction with her head actually smashed, and she was placed in a ditch.
That or the other unsolved murder I was telling you, uh-huh. The sheriff's department, the girl was found out in Saratoga County.
Yeah.
This is the bar that she's last seen at.
Wow. And what was her name? Pamela?
Pam DeVizio.
Okay.
That was in, I want to say, 87.
Yeah.
So July 4th, she's seen there, and she starts walking, but she's walking up the other direction, but away from this bar here.
Dude, is there any connection that you guys?
Not that we could see.
Yeah.
You know, there very well could be. I don't want to say yes or no, but not that we could see from.
We sat down with that investigator from the county who's working that as a cold case now, and he brought over the crime scene photos from where she's found and how she's found and our crime scene photos. I mean, that was very violent, very just looks like a rageful, you know, attack. And this doesn't seem to be. I mean, obviously anytime you kill somebody, it's not an act of love. Yeah, this bar here now is called Dango Fitzgerald's. It's an Irish pub. It was called Madame Jamel's at the time. That was in, like I said, I want to say 1986, 87. Young woman named Pamela DeVizio is working here, 4th of July. That's when she's last seen. She has a, like an after shift, or she'd been out that night, stops back here for a cocktail, and then is walking back to her apartment, which is up in the east side of town over here. That's the last that she's ever seen alive, and she's found out in Saratoga County in a rural area in like a drainage ditch.
Yeah.
Somebody driving by, see, or I think walking his dog, ends up finding her. So that's also an unsolved murder. That one is our county sheriffs have that jurisdiction because it's not in our city here. But, you know,
it's got a connection.
Yeah, it was something that we definitely wanted to look into. We're like, you know, like, so you don't get a lot of women getting murdered, going missing from here, and she's last seen leaving the bar district.
How was she killed?
Looks like she was beaten with some sort of blunt instrument.
Blunt object to the head.
Yeah, so she's beaten.
Just to the head?
Badly.
I don't think there was any other wounds.
No, it's more to the head, but then she's been out. It looks like it's like a couple of days that she's out in summertime. Mm-hmm. So I think somebody actually, that's what it was, somebody going by sees like an animal, like guy's dog had gotten out. So they don't know exactly how much that's from the attack, how much is from her being out, you know, in the elements, exposed mm-hmm. to, you know, animals going by, you know, whatever else.
So completely different MO as from Sheila, right?
Looks different than
Yeah, she's, I mean, Sheila's, it's the cause of death was asphyxiation. So she has a gag in her mouth, and then it's, the scene is almost staged to look like it's violent. She's tied up. She's stabbed in the abdomen, but it all looks to be post-mortem. Like the stab wound, they have a picture from the autopsy where the knife doesn't hit any organs.
The organs, yeah.
Nothing that would, and it's a small, it's like a, it's a, not a butter knife, but it's like the size of a butter knife. Like
steak knife, like a small steak knife.
But you'd have trouble cutting a steak with it. It's not, definitely not like a, you know,
was it still
Hanzo.
In her?
It was still in her when they found her, yeah.
And that's like in evidence right now and everything.
We have a lot of stuff that we've sent down to the state police lab, and I just called them the other day, you know, hoping to get an update for you guys before you came in here, and they're like, you know, unfortunately you're still in the queue, you know, waiting. And we turned the stuff in November, and they're like, you know, we're definitely going to get it assigned and get all this stuff now tested for DNA and retest all the fingerprints, make sure to put them in the national database. But they're like, you know, unfortunately, the hits keep coming, you know. Yeah. So when they get a new murder or something that goes to the top of the list or something that's scheduled for trial, that they're like, they'll put a rush on it, have to get this tested and go forward with that. So I'm just hopefully going to keep annoying them to the point that, you know, they'll bump us up some. I get tired of hearing from me.
Yeah.
And there's a chance that there's some break in the case based on that evidence?
We certainly hope
so. We like to hope so, but then, you know, you got to figure they're collecting evidence not for DNA purposes, you know. So anybody who's anybody's touching it, when it's stored, who's touching it, who's moving boxes, you know, their packaging is not the same as it is now. They have also gone through several different moves where they moved evidence to different locations. As time went on, we had to rebuild. They had to rebuild different places. So who knows what was in there, you know, damage to the elements, from the elements and whatnot. So it's, you know, you try to be hopeful.
Yeah.
But you also don't want to get your hopes up too much because you just know how things were, you know, the DNA.
Do you think it's going to end up being something, if it is solved, that it would be something with DNA, or would it be something where someone confesses?
I would take either. For me, I would like to see a piece of evidence that no one thought to get DNA off of.
Yeah.
And then find it that way.
Yeah.
Or at least a starting point.
Do you have an idea of what that would be?
I don't. There was a lot of odds and end items from the apartment that we still had that we sent out there that maybe was touched that no one thought to test, like magazines and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
But it's you know, it's one of those things where the way that it was handled, not putting a you know, not degrading anyone else's, you know, how they did things, but it was a different world back then. We didn't have DNA. It was more.
Well, they didn't know what they didn't have the foresight to, because it didn't exist.
Exactly, it didn't exist. So it's like everyone's going for fingerprints and so.
Is there any clothing left? Oh, sorry.
There's some clothing, you know, from the time, and they, you know, it seems like they did a great job of just collecting everything. You're like, you know, if it could possibly be involved, just take it and secure it, you know, better to have it and not need it, you know, type thing than vice versa. The one piece that we had sent in, we got a report back, a serology report, that first thing they did was test everything for blood, and they did find a shoe in the apartment that tested positive in the serology report, so that was really exciting. But now then that has to go for DNA testing, you know, find out whose blood we're talking about. And
blood on the shoe.
Blood on the shoe and Sheila's shoe in the apartment.
Yeah.
Yep, so we're, you know, obviously that's a great place to start, you know, as far as somebody would have a lot of explaining to do of why their blood would be on a shoe in a, you know, apartment of a murder victim.
And another unsolved murder that we touch on is Jennifer Hammond, who part of her body was located in Saratoga County, New York, in 2009.
I was sent an article about this Jennifer Hammond, who was found in Ballston Spa.
Mm-hmm. That's where we're staying, right?
Yeah. So that's obviously huge year difference. That was 2003, it seems like. But
I don't know too much about that case. Yeah. I remember hearing about it. I know the sheriff's department. We have another missing person that we believe is a homicide. She was 14 in 86. We haven't found the body yet. The person of interest that we believe, or that the other investigators believe did it, is no longer with us either. Hmm. And we just digged on the property where we thought she was buried.
Oh, really?
Came up negative, yeah.
You just did that?
We just did that. Not last year, year
two
before.
2 years ago?
2 years ago. But the mother still talks to me. She'll still call, wants, you know, if I hear anything or not.
Yeah.
She was actually at the
seminar where we met you guys.
Really? She was there with, who's the other?
From upstate New York.
Oh, yeah. Lyle, right? Susan Lyle. Susan Lyle's mother.
Laura. That's great that she's so active.
Yeah, it's a long time, but even talking to her, talking to the sister, they News Channel 13 did a story, and they interviewed me in regards to it. Mm-hmm. And when you talk to the mom and, you know, how this 14-year-old was hitchhiking to and hanging out with a 30-year-old man and all this stuff going on, and nobody really seemed to think it was that big of a deal. It paints a picture of the 80s, like, what was going on back then? Yeah. You know, it's just, yeah, it's a different time, different age, and people a little more lax than they are now. You know, you, when you tell the story, even with this, you know, the red flags kind of pop up, as maybe then you didn't think much of it.
Yeah.
It's interesting to think about the time periods like that, like the 60s and 70s, and, mm-hmm. you know, the 80s weren't that far removed.
No.
But so much happened. So much happened from, like 1966 to 86. You know, yeah. It feels like 50 years.
Yep.
And then, you know, we come from it from this point of view. We're like, you know, why would you ever hitchhike? Why would you ever, leave your window open?
Yeah.
You know, like that.
Or your doors unlocked.
Nobody had those stories then.
Yeah, yeah, your keys in your car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I can't even wrap my head around. Like, I would never do that on purpose.
Yeah. Well, all the crazy stuff that happened then that we're dealing, you know, that we're looking into is the reason why we don't do it now.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why I keep my kid inside.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had that conversation about, yeah.
I still get in fights with my wife, though, whenever I have to go to move her car, get something out of the car. I'm like, why is your car always locked? Like, it's in our driveway. Like, we're, like, it's, you know, a quiet, like, you know, cul-de-sac neighborhood, and she's like, yep, you say that now, but... Yeah. Or, like, I don't always think to lock the door, but we also have a pit bull, and in this line of work, it's 99 times out of 100, somebody coming to burglarize your house or break in, you know, they're looking for a soft target. I'm like, that one bark out of that guy, and they're not going to stick around to find out he's friendly.
And now we're back at the police station, and actually inside the police station. Lance, first time in years for me. How about you?
First time that we went into a police station where we voluntarily went into a police station, at least.
That's not true, actually.
That's not true, yeah. It was interesting to be in that police station because I always have this perception of a, you know, slick, like, CSI scene, but you get a really solid reality check when you see how hard these men and women of any police force, but this one in particular, the Saratoga police force, I mean, there's stacks of paper, they have their case files out. They have writing on the wall, literally writing on the walls, and it's just an ongoing wheel of work that you can see happens on a daily basis there.
Yeah, and that's a part of this conversation. We kind of talk about how there's differences today and how there was back then.
This is what we'll bring with us tomorrow. So this this binder is this and that other blue binder right here are the case file of what was transferred over, this and this that are all... Yeah. You know, mostly hand, typewriter, but a lot of, you know, handwritten stuff that, you know, call came in and, you know, mm-hmm. patrol officer writes his report or, you know, type, depending on whether it's, you know, really investigator, supervisor, if they had access to a typewriter at mm-hmm. the time, you name it, you know, real good tips of, I think I saw her with this person at this time, you know, I had a dream that that this person killed her, and you should probably go talk to him. To, you know, they got cases from Ithaca, from Buffalo, different serial killers that were active at the time that people had called in. It's really pretty impressive that, you know, without an internet, that they were able to look up these cases all, you know, around the country. I still don't really fully understand how it worked at the time that they could be in contact with, you know, with a Buffalo PD to even find out they had, you know, something where it's like a similar MO mm-hmm. to this one.
How often do you look through that?
Every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least, you know, something. Or I've been going through, you know, more recently with you guys coming here to kind of refresh my memory of different details, because there's so much, and you see, you know, so many follow ups, so many names. So you're like, why do I remember that name, or who was this person again? But when, you know, when I first got the case, it was literally just months of every day going through and then making my own notes and like, okay, go back and talk to this guy or try to find out where this guy is. Because, you know, some of them, they're like, they're, you know, a nickname of, you know, go find this guy, you know, Willie. Okay, who's Willie? You know, and how do we start to find out, you know, who he is or what his real name is and, you know, phone number. So it's, you know, definitely like putting a puzzle together. You know, certainly we're lucky that we still have Tom Mitchell and Dan Jewett and the guys that had worked you know, worked this at the time that that both have been really, you know, fresh too. When I've called them just to run something by them. I've called Tom a couple times because something will pop into my mind, like, hey, did you ever think of this? Or you try that? And he's like, oh yeah, I remember that was a Thursday in July and we did that. Like, God, like it's crazy, you know, the stuff that they still remember from this, right, from this case. Yeah. So without having the detectives from the time, it definitely would have been much more of an uphill battle than it already is, which it is.
Yeah. Is there anything that, like, do you go through that and you see something that you didn't see before?
Yeah, I mean, I was just making a...
And what's that feeling like after you are looking into this for so long?
It's one of those, I don't want to interrupt them, but there's times where I've looked at something, I'm like, and I hadn't looked at it in a while, and I'm looking, and I go, did I read this already? It looks new now. And he's like, no, yeah, that was this, and, you know, and I have to get, you know, reminded that.
But yeah, there's certain ones, though, where we've read them. You know, like, I've read them, and Matt's read them, and something doesn't jump out to you. But, like, this was, you know, this was a list that I just made in the last, you know, 2 days, you know, those two pages of, you know, going back through, like, well, you know what, actually, what about this guy? Let's see if we can find this person who's mentioned, you know, just even in passing in the case report. And then there was one that I just gave him this afternoon, like an hour before you guys got here. I'm like, hey, do you remember reading this? Like, this definitely sounds like somebody that, you know, we'll want to talk to. So I guess that's the point now of going back through and back through is, you know, you hope it's something where, did I miss something? And then, you know, going back, sometimes I have, and just recently, like, okay, now I got a new list of people to interview and talk to and go back and talk to again. That's how I started, was going through, just reading through the whole binder. And I had a pad of paper, a legal pad, and filled, you know, five pages of just names, you know, and then how they're related, just a real quick one sentence, and filled, you know, probably four or five pages of, these are the people I want to talk to. And we started with the detectives that worked it initially, and then went from there to her family, to her close friends. And we're, you know, we're holding off on suspects for the most part, because we do have the evidence out, you know, with the state police lab. So wait until that comes back first, and hopefully it'll steer us.
How many suspects do you have?
I mean, ones that have been already vetted back then and ruled out, or just...
Current ones that have not been ruled out.
Six, seven.
Yeah, it fluctuates every time I look at that thing. Wow.
Okay. You feel pretty good that the killer is one of those, six or seven?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no, because, you know, like Matt said, like, If it's somebody that she just met who was, you know, in town for a night, and, you know, one of those, like, just, you know, real unfortunate meetings where, you know, she met the wrong person and went home with her, then, you know, other than DNA, I don't know how you ever identify that, you know, that person. Whereas, you know, the hope is that it's somebody that's known to her that's in, you know, in one of these two binders somewhere, because that's, you know, a lot better of a starting point for us, you know, a lot more.
Do you think that person's in the binder?
I think so. You know, I'm pretty confident if I had to lean, but I would say I'm more of a, you know, 60-40 than 90-10
sure.
with somebody in here. Because I also just got a tip, I think I was telling Tim on the phone, of my sergeant mentioned to me a couple of weeks ago. He goes, you know, I'm just watching something on Investigative Network or something, and this guy popped up as a serial killer in Buffalo, New York, in the late 70s and 80s. And he's like, you know, you may want to, he's still, you know, still in custody. You know, maybe you guys want to, you know, see what you can do with that. And so I don't know. I kind of hope from this is that it's something that's a call comes in or a tip comes in of something that really focuses on somebody that we've already thought of, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And most of the information that we pushed out, you know, since it started, you know, back in the 80s, was your local news, you know, which covers in Capital District. So if some of these people that might have been involved are no longer here, they're not, you know, obviously watching News Channel 13, you know, in Colorado or wherever. So
reading,
it's like
Reading the Saratoga.
Yeah. And so I kind of wanted to push the information a little bit farther outside of the Capital District to see if maybe there's somebody out there that's like, you know what, I was in Saratoga during this time, and I kind of remember meeting this girl, you know, in the downtown area, and it looked like this woman, and she was with some, you know, person, and describe that person, you know, I never thought of it until, you know, something came up and jogged their memory.
Sure.
Yeah, somebody's wife or husband, it says, yeah, actually, my husband told me, you know, years ago this girl he killed in upstate New York and never really knew where it was or where to look.
Actually,
or
he was just pulling my leg and tell us, and now I'm right. reading the story about it. You know?
That's an actual story.
Yeah.
Oh.
No, I'm just saying, I mean, that's just, you know, that's my hope. That's my hope is, right? Hope,
yeah,
is
gotcha.
You know.
Yeah, because every murder you ever hear of, other than, you know, somebody like a, you know, Berkowitz or one of these, you know, act alone serial killers, they tell somebody, you know, like you, mm-hmm. I've never really heard of a murder unless it's like a serial killer type person where they just go to their grave and they never mention this thing. You know, it seems hard to fathom that could, you know.
Usually the cases they tell a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And those people just don't even, mm-hmm. you know, do anything about it, or they don't think they're serious or,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah. And we're hoping with this, and we started kind of trying to get the media, you know, to put this stuff out, and they were interested as well. Like last November, we did a few different stories, but like Matt said, they're all local. They're all local in our local paper, and thinking we get this flood of new calls coming in, we got like 6 phone calls, mm-hmm. you know, about this. So it definitely wasn't what we've been hoping for. But, you know, like you said, maybe it's somebody who left Saratoga in 1980 and hasn't come back since. So. Mm-hmm. You know, we're hoping that somebody didn't want to come forward then, or was scared, or for whatever reason, then they'll see something and say, you know, I want to get this off my chest, and yeah. had this information for almost 40 years now.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
with the Tammy McCormick case, I was talking to you guys about when the officers did it in 2012, they went back, talked to all the officers that were involved in it, and that was back in '86, and they said, who should we, you know, who would you talk to again if you had to go back and do it? Because I would talk to this person, and like, well, why this person? He's not even listed. You know, anywhere in the case, it's like a small blurb, and he goes, well, you know, nobody took him seriously. He was a kid, and no one really wanted to talk to him. So they traveled out to Buffalo and spoke to him, and the first thing out of his mouth is, this is about my friend Tammy, and what took you guys so long to come out here? You know, so it's one of those things, like, I kind of hoped that would happen with us,
yeah.
You know, what took you so long to come out and talk to me if you didn't know, you know, who you were?
Yeah.
You know?
And here's a funny clip about a page in the file, in the case file, that is about her mom reporting on her son.
What's crazy about that is that was just one example of the hundreds, maybe thousands, of reports that they got in over the subsequent days and months and years following Sheila's death. And they have to follow up on all of those.
Oh, yeah, this one of those ones we were talking about where you get the random, you know, call just comes in that, this guy's a weirdo, so
yeah.
You got to take a look at him. Really nothing to connect him to Saratoga, or this sounds like the mom wanted to get her son out of the house.
They would record a lot of the tip lines.
Oh, yeah, actually, you read this one. Contacted the caller. She reports her son has no connection to the homicide, but that she mentioned his case in front of the deputy when he was there in an attempt to scare her son. States that he's unemployed and just hangs around the house all day. She thought this may shake him up enough to get him seeking employment. Well, that's good to use a open murder investigation to get your son to get a job.
And in this final clip, we discuss what may be an interesting clue in the case.
Yeah, and as I said before, this one, you know, potential lead or this one element is truly fascinating to me. It's just something that stands out because I don't know if someone would just imagine a light in there, and enough to the effect of specifying it as a flashlight, sort of darting around in the dark. That's incredibly telling to me, and I wish we knew more about it.
Yeah, it's sort of a clue that plays out in some of the next episodes in this series. So we'll come back to this one for sure. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Oh yeah, this would definitely would have got me. Got me excited if I was working at the time when they went by and saw the light on in the apartment. I thought somebody had gone back to the scene. Yeah, I saw what appeared to be the light of a flashlight inside the apartment. That's a week later. At 11:48 p.m., that would certainly get my attention.
Usually. Thank you.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.